my place in tech changes every day. But I don't fear the future, because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts, so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
Welcome to the Meteorology Matters podcast. Today, we're taking a moment to reflect on something really significant. It's the 20th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina.
It really is a major milestone.
An event that wasn't just about, you know, the incredible destruction, but how it fundamentally changed how we look at natural disasters and maybe more importantly, how we prepare or don't prepare.
That's the unsettling part, isn't it?
Yeah.
Looking back, you see so much progress, so much change in how we handle these storms.
Mm-hmm.
But then you also see these echoes, these challenges from 20 years ago that feel, well, uncomfortably close even now.
Absolutely. So our mission today on Meteorology Matters is to really unpack that complex legacy. We'll trace Katrina's meteorological journey, which was ferocious.
Oh, absolutely.
We'll look at the huge challenges in the human response, the recovery efforts, which were often chaotic.
To say the least.
And then, importantly, explore how those lessons, the hard-won ones, and maybe the ones we've let slip, how they still shape our vulnerability today.
Exactly. We want to pull out the critical insights, look at Katrina's impact, how disaster management and hurricane science have evolved since 05.
What did we actually learn? What really got better?
And why are some top experts now ringing alarm bells saying we might be, you know, backsliding, slipping back into some dangerous old habits?
It's a huge story. Nature's power, yes, but also human systems, human resilience, and, well, sometimes human failure.
It really is.
Okay, so to really get a grip on Katrina's impact, we have to go back to the storm itself, the raw power.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we often hear disasters are unforeseen, but the warnings for New Orleans, they were stark. Let's start at the beginning, the storm's birth.
Right. It wasn't just one thing. It was kind of a meteorological mix. You had a tropical wave, remnants of an old depression, an upper-level trough.
All coming together.
Yeah, coalescing over the southeastern Bahamas. That was August 23rd, 2005. And it didn't hang around.
No time wasted.
Pretty quickly. August 24th, it's Tropical Storm Katrina. A day later, boom, hurricane status.
And its first landfall was Florida.
That's right. Category 1, southeastern Florida, right near the Miami-Dade, Broward County line, August 25th.
Okay.
But here's the thing. Usually crossing land, especially a peninsula like Florida, it tears a storm up.
Yeah, disrupts the core.
But Katrina, its eyes stayed remarkably intact crossing the Everglades, which are, you know, very wet, but still land.
So it maintained its structure.
It did, which meant as soon as it hit that warm Gulf of Mexico water, it was perfectly set up to re-intensify.
Fast, like adding fuel to a fire.
Exactly. High-octane fuel for a supercharged engine.
And intensify feels like an understatement. It just exploded in the Gulf.
It really did. We saw two distinct periods of rapid intensification. That's where a storm strengthens incredibly quickly.
Grindingly fast.
Yeah. In less than 12 hours, this was August 28th, Katrina just surged. Went from a Category 3 to a monster Category 5.
Wow. That speed itself is a lesson, isn't it? Even with warnings, these shifts can happen so fast.
Perilously fast. Reduces reaction time down to almost nothing. That rapid intensification, it peaked at 150 knots. That's 173 miles per hour winds.
Just hard to even imagine that force.
And the pressure dropped like a stone.
Yeah.
Down to 902 millibars. At the time, that was the fourth lowest pressure ever recorded in the Atlantic.
And that low pressure, it's not just a number, is it? It's what pulls the ocean inward.
Essentially, yes.
Yeah.
It creates a vacuum effect that helps lift the sea surface, contributing massively to the storm surge. Predicting that kind of explosive growth is, well, the holy grail for forecasters, because it leaves communities so little time.
So after hitting that peak, that Cat 5 monster status, it did weaken slightly before hitting Louisiana.
It did, yeah. It settled back to a Category 3 before its first Louisiana landfall near Burris. Winds around 127 miles per hour, 110 knots.
Still incredibly powerful.
Absolutely. And then a second landfall a few hours later near the Louisiana-Mississippi border, still a Cat 3, about 121 miles per hour.
What caused that weakening? Just natural fluctuations?
Mostly internal changes. It went through something called an eyewall replacement cycle. Think of it like the storm reorganizing, forming a new, often larger eye.
So the peak winds might drop a bit, but the storm gets bigger.
Exactly. And that's crucial. Even as a Cat 3, Katrina was exceptionally large. Its hurricane force winds stretched way out from the center.
Meaning the damage footprint was huge.
Massive. That size was a huge factor in the catastrophic storm surge it generated. It reminds you, the category number isn't the whole story. Size matters a lot.
Okay, let's shift focus to New Orleans itself, the city's geography. It just seems tailor-made for disaster.
It's tragically unique. Over 80% of the city is at or below sea level. It really is like a bowl.
Protected by levees?
Protected by a complex system of levees and flood walls, yes. But that very geography made it incredibly vulnerable.
And that vulnerability wasn't just natural, right? Human actions played a part.
A huge part. Decades of wetland loss and coastal erosion had stripped away the city's natural defenses.
Those marshes and swamps acted like a buffer.
A massive buffer. They absorbed storm surge, slowed down winds. But as they disappeared, the Gulf of Mexico basically moved closer to the city's doorstep.
Bringing the full force of the storm right in. A lesson in messing with natural systems.
A profound one.
And the really tough part is, this wasn't a secret. The danger was known. Predicted, even.
Well, absolutely. It wasn't a surprise attack. Back in 2002, the New Orleans Times-Picayune ran this incredible 10-part series. Called it The Big One.
Chilling title.
And it laid out exactly what could happen. Predicted a major hurricane could put 20 feet of water in the city.
20 feet. That's not a vague warning. That's a specific, terrifying forecast.
It was. And scientists were sounding the alarm, too. Ivor Van Heerden, who was co-director of LSU's Hurricane Center then, he specifically warned the Army Corps of Engineers.
About the levees themselves.
Yes. He pointed out the parts were built on soft soil, prone to erosion, prone to failure.
And the Corps' response?
He recalled it being quite dismissive. Something like, these are federal levees built to federal standards. They're not going to fail.
Wow. A sort of institutional blindness.
Or perhaps overconfidence.
Mm.
Ignoring the specific local risks, the science being presented.
And the warnings kept coming. There was that FEMA simulation exercise.
Right. Just a year before Katrina in 2004, Hurricane Pam, funded by FEMA.
And what did Pam predict?
Pretty much exactly what happened. Thousands of deaths, citywide flooding from a slow-moving Category 3 hitting New Orleans. It was a dry run for the apocalypse.
So the blueprint for disaster was right there.
It was. But Van Heerden, who was involved in PAM, he felt the federal officials just didn't grasp the severity. He even mentioned hearing laughter in back rooms during his presentation, like he was just some geek with a strange accent.
That's incredibly frustrating. If the warnings were so clear, so detailed, why wasn't more done?
That's the billion-dollar question, isn't it? It seems it wasn't a lack of knowledge, but a failure to act on that knowledge, a failure to connect the dots and invest appropriately.
And the consequence of that failure was the impact of the storm itself. The storm surge, you described it as monumental.
It truly was. Along a 20-mile stretch of the Mississippi coast, it hit 24 to 28 feet. The peak recorded was 27.8 feet at Pass Christian.
Can you even visualize that? Three stories high.
Pretty much. A wall of churning water. And it wasn't just one spot. Eastern New Orleans, St. Bernard Parish, Plaquemines Parish.
Okay.
They got 15 to 19 feet.
Still catastrophic.
Absolutely. Even Western New Orleans saw 10 to 14 feet.
Yeah.
It just overwhelmed the defenses.
And the levees, they failed.
They did. The surge poured over the tops and just eroded them from the backside. Major breaches along the Industrial Canal, the London Avenue Canal, the 17th Street Canal.
Leading to that unbelievable flooding figure, 80% of the city.
80%. Some areas under 20 feet of water. And it took 43 days. 43 days to pump it all out.
Just let that sink in.
Yeah.
43 days underwater.
The scale is hard to comprehend.
And the human cost? Equally immense.
Horrifying. Katrina remains one of the deadliest U.S. hurricanes. 1,392 total fatalities.
And that includes direct and indirect deaths.
Yes. 520 direct deaths, people killed by the storm itself, mostly storm surge. And then 565 indirect deaths. Things like heat stress during the aftermath, lack of medical care, accidents during cleanup.
Mostly in Louisiana and Mississippi.
Predominantly. Louisiana deaths were mostly from the flooding and its aftermath. Mississippi saw more direct storm surge fatalities.
Yeah.
These numbers, they represent shattered families, lost communities.
The personal stories are just heartbreaking. Robert Green from the Lower Ninth Ward.
Yeah, his account. His house floating away, his family, mother, grandkids clinging to the roof.
And tragically, losing his mother and granddaughter.
Yet his resilience, saying, I'm a New Orleanian.
Yeah.
Participating in the commemorative parades now. It speaks volumes about the spirit there.
So, I mean, it's unimaginable loss. and the economic toll.
Astronomical. $125 billion in damage back in 2005.
Which adjusts to?
About $186.3 billion in 2022. Still the costliest U.S. hurricane ever.
That number alone tells you the scale. It's not just a human tragedy, but an economic cataclysm with impacts that last for generations.
Absolutely. A profound economic shock.
Which brings us to the evacuation and the initial response.
Mm.
And chaos seems like the right word.
Utter chaos.
Yeah.
A systemic failure, really. Governor Blanco issued a mandatory evacuation, but maybe 100,000 people stayed behind.
Why? Couldn't get out.
Many lacked transportation, lacked resources. It starkly highlighted the social inequities that disasters always expose. The plans to use school buses, city buses.
Yeah.
They just didn't happen.
Leaving thousands stranded.
Exactly. And the designated shelters, they weren't much better. The Superdome, the shelter of last resort, was overwhelmed almost immediately.
And the convention center, reports from there were horrific.
Desperate. No food, no water, no medical care, no security. Reports of lawlessness. It became this symbol of absolute system breakdown. A place of supposed safety turned into a scene of intense suffering.
What's almost unbelievable is the apparent lack of awareness at the top. That interview with DHS Secretary Chertoff.
Right. 3 days after landfall, and he seemed unaware of the conditions at the convention center. He thought the Superdome, the official site, was supplied.
But the convention center was where thousands ended up spontaneously.
Precisely. It showed this massive disconnect. A failure of real-time situational awareness at the highest levels of government.
Mm.
They just didn't seem to know what was happening on the ground.
That disconnect wasn't just a momentary lapse, was it? It pointed to deeper problems in the federal response structure itself. FEMA came under incredible fire.
Intense fire.
Yeah.
And you have to look back a bit. In 2003, FEMA got absorbed into the new Department of Homeland Security.
Post-9/11 reorganization, focus on counterterrorism.
Right. But experts like Sarah DeYoung argue that MOVE cut FEMA off from direct access to the president, hindered its ability to act quickly and decisively in a natural disaster, took away its clout, essentially.
And it wasn't just structure, but people, too. The brain drain.
Samantha Montano talks about that. The reorganization led to experienced expert staff leaving FEMA. You lose that institutional knowledge, that expertise built over years.
And you're left vulnerable when a crisis hits.
Critically vulnerable. As Stephen Murphy from Tulane said, in New Orleans, FEMA became a four-letter word. That tells you everything about the public perception, the loss of trust.
And trust is everything in a disaster.
Absolutely vital. Without it, recovery is 10 times harder.
The official review afterward, the Bush administration report, it laid out numerous failings, 14 critical challenges.
Yeah, it was a pretty stark assessment.
Instead of listing all 14 like a checklist, maybe we can group them, see the bigger patterns of failure. It seems like the core issue was the system just wasn't built for something this big.
That's a great way to look at it. A catastrophe overwhelmed a system designed for lesser disasters. So let's maybe start with a theme of command, communication, and coordination chaos.
Sounds about right.
First, just basic national preparedness. The report found structural flaws. No unified management for a catastrophe, unclear command control. Key leaders weren't even familiar with the basic playbook, the National Response Plan, or the Incident Command System.
So the plan existed, but people didn't know how to use it.
Or it wasn't robust enough for this scale. Then you had the integrated use of military capabilities. The DOD had this cumbersome 21-step process just to request help.
21 steps while a city drowns.
Exactly. Slow, bureaucratic. Plus, poor coordination between active duty military and the National Guard because they had separate command chains, like two hands not knowing what the other's doing.
Which obviously links to communications.
Totally broken. Okay. Katrina literally wiped out the infrastructure, cell towers down, landlines dead. It wasn't just about radios not talking to each other, though that was also an issue.
The whole network collapsed.
Right. And even when assets were available, like a big cache of radios from the Forest Service, there was no plan to integrate them. The communication backbone just snapped.
And that breakdown extended to talking to the public, public communications.
Mm-hmm. NOAA and the National Hurricane Center did a great job getting the weather warnings out beforehand. That saved lives, no question.
But during and after.
State and local officials didn't use the emergency alert system effectively. And worse, you had conflicting messages coming from different government sources. That created confusion, eroded trust. Right when people needed clear information most.
Confusion is the enemy in a crisis.
Absolutely. And this coordination chaos even hampered dealing with outside help. Foreign assistance, for instance.
We weren't ready for international aid.
Shockingly unprepared. 151 nations offered help.
Yeah.
But the U.S. lacked systems to manage it, prioritize it, integrate it. Bureaucracy led to delays, unused resources. It was embarrassing. We couldn't even track foreign nationals affected.
And what about help from within the U.S., non-governmental groups?
Non-governmental aid was huge. Faith-based groups, NGOs, they did incredible work, often despite government hurdles.
But they weren't integrated into the plan.
No real plan existed to leverage them effectively. A failure to harness the power of civil society, which is often first on the ground.
Okay, so that's the command and coordination mess. What's the next big theme?
It's called the logistical and humanitarian crisis. This covers getting resources and aid to people.
Starting with just basic logistics and evacuations?
The system was totally inadequate. Federal managers struggled to figure out what was needed where, how to track supplies, how to use private companies effectively. And the feds were unprepared for mass evacuations when local efforts failed, hence the Superdome disaster.
Yeah. And search and rescue, you mentioned coordination issues there too.
Severely hampered. No single integrated command. Coast Guard, FEMA teams, DOD, often working in silos.
Leading to duplication or gaps.
Right. Rescued people were sometimes just dropped off, like on highway overpasses with no support. And many SAR teams weren't even trained for water rescue, which was the main need.
And then there's public safety and security, law and order breakdown.
It deteriorated rapidly, especially in New Orleans. The local police were overwhelmed. Many were victims themselves. Federal law enforcement was slow to arrive and lacked pre-planned coordination. It made a terrifying situation even more dangerous.
Healthcare must have collapsed, too. Public health and medical support.
Completely overwhelmed. Louisiana and Mississippi were already ranked 49th and 50th in public health infrastructure before the storm.
So they had no capacity for this?
None. Federal medical assets were poorly coordinated. Aid was delayed. Resources sat unused. Volunteer doctors and nurses weren't managed effectively. Just chaos.
And for the survivors who lost everything, human services.
A bureaucratic nightmare. Vulnerable people navigating complex systems just to get basic help. Disaster recovery centers were supposed to be one-stop shops, but they weren't. People bounced from agency to agency.
Adding trauma to trauma.
Exactly. And finally, under this theme, mass care and housing. Just finding places for hundreds of thousands of displaced people.
The scale was unprecedented.
And the plans were inadequate. Federal solutions like cruise ships and those infamous trailers often didn't meet people's needs. And expertise from agencies like HUD wasn't brought in effectively until much later.
Trying to solve a massive, complex problem with ill-fitting, slow solutions?
Pretty much.
Okay, one more big theme from that report.
Yes, let's call it infrastructure and environmental neglect. Things beyond the immediate human crisis.
Like critical infrastructure itself. Power. Energy.
Katrina hammered it. Especially the energy sector. Millions lost power. But federal efforts to assess and repair were hampered by poor coordination between different support functions and between federal, state, and local levels. There wasn't even a good understanding of how different infrastructure systems depended on each other.
Like power fails, then water pumps fail.
Exactly. Cascading failures. And the damage assessment teams often lacked the specific expertise needed for things like power grids or refineries.
And the environment. Environmental hazards and debris removal must have been huge issues.
Massive. Over 7 million gallons of oil spilled. Superfund hazardous waste sites flooded. But identifying these hazards and warning people was slow, hampered by other priorities. And debris removal, especially from private property, got bogged down in complex rules. A mountain of debris made recovery even harder.
So, taken together, those 14 points, grouped like that, they paint a devastating picture of a system totally unprepared.
Fundamentally unprepared for a catastrophe of that scale. It revealed deep flaws in almost every aspect of disaster management.
Which makes it even more concerning to hear experts now talking about backsliding. 20 years later, are we forgetting those lessons?
That's the fear. It's alarming. Experts within the system are raising these concerns.
What does backsliding actually mean in practice? Fewer resources, less expertise.
Both and more. Samantha Montano stated quite bluntly that many gains FEMA made post-Katrina have backslid in the past 4 months, echoing the pre-Katrina vulnerabilities.
That's a strong statement.
It is, and there are specifics. FEMA has reportedly lost about a quarter of its full-time staff, including senior leaders.
Experience walking out the door.
Exactly. And there's concern about political appointees lacking real emergency management expertise. The current acting administrator, David Richardson, reports say he came from counter-WMD work, the Marines. and was reportedly unaware the U.S. has a hurricane season.
Wait, seriously? Unaware of hurricane season?
That was the report. Whether it's entirely accurate or not, it signals a worrying trend mirroring the pre-Katrina era when political connections sometimes trumped expertise in appointments.
That brain drain again. Losing the people who actually know how to manage these events.
It's a direct threat. Expertise isn't optional in this field, it's critical.
And it's not just personnel. What about funding, budget cuts, and program freezes?
Also happening. $750 million cut from the BRIC grant program that's for building resilient infrastructure before disasters hit.
So, less prevention money.
And reportedly, no new hazard mitigation grants allocated to states since February 2025, despite applications piling up. That's leaving communities more vulnerable down the line.
And then there are bureaucratic hurdles, making it harder for FEMA to actually operate.
Yes. Bureaucratic hurdles and restrictive policies. Reports suggest new expense policies under DHS Secretary Kristi Noem have slowed things down dramatically. Thousands of contracts backlogged for basic things like cell phones or crucial things like debris removal.
So even if they have the money, they can't spend it quickly.
That seems to be the issue. It reportedly caused delays during the Texas floods in July 2025. If your rapid response agency is tangled in red tape, how can it respond rapidly?
It's gotten so bad that FEMA employees themselves are protesting.
Over 180 signed a letter to Congress, warning that current leadership and policies risk a Katrina-level disaster, calling for FEMA to be independent outside of DHS.
That's extraordinary internal dissent like that.
It signals deep problems. And there have been odd staff reassignments, too. Dozens of FEMA staff reportedly reassigned to help ICE with recruitment.
Taking disaster experts away from disaster prep.
Employees argue it violates the post-Katrina reforms meant to protect FEMA's mission capability. It directly weakens hurricane season readiness.
This all feeds into a bigger debate about the federal role, doesn't it? Proposals to eliminate FEMA.
Yes, the administration has floated that idea, leaving it all to the states. But polling shows 3/4 of Americans reject that.
People seem to understand states can't handle this alone.
Experts certainly do. LT General Russell Honoré, the man who led the military response in Katrina, is adamant. No state can handle a major storm, thousands of rescues, mass evacuations without federal help.
The military only got involved because the state was overwhelmed.
Exactly. And Stephen Murphy at Tulane says New Orleans simply wouldn't have recovered without federal support.
So what's the real cost of inaction here if we allow this backsliding?
It means states will be unable to cope financially or logistically with the next big one. Louisiana's entire budget in 2005 was $17.5 billion. Katrina cost $125 billion. The math doesn't work.
So disinvestment now means exponentially higher costs and money and lives later.
Precisely. It's forgetting the most fundamental economic lesson of Katrina. Preparation and prevention pay huge dividends. Backsliding is fiscally irresponsible and dangerous.
Okay, that's sobering. But let's pivot to something more positive. Because alongside these systemic worries, there have been huge leaps in the science, right? Meteorology and forecasting.
Absolutely. That's the encouraging part of the story. Katrina, Rita, Wilma, that brutal 2005 season, it really galvanized the research community.
Spurred investment.
Big time. It led directly to the Hurricane Forecast Improvement Project, HVIP. Launched by NOAA in 2007, a major collaborative effort.
And they set some pretty audacious goals.
Extremely ambitious. Congress mandated they improve track and intensity forecasts by 50% within a decade.
50%? Did they actually hit that?
Largely, yes. By 2023, a 5-day track forecast was as accurate as a 2-day forecast was back in 2005. Think about that extra lead time.
That's huge for evacuations, preparations.
Massive. And intensity forecast errors dropped 56% between 2007 and 2023. Even rapid intensification forecasting improved by 25%. It's a remarkable success.
As Jeff Master said, funding works. Invest in the science, get better forecasts.
It's clear proof of concept.
So what's behind these improvements? Better computers.
That's a big part of it. Advanced computer models.
Right.
We have much more powerful supercomputers now, like at the NOAA lab in Boulder. They can run models with much finer detail, especially resolving the storm's inner core, which is key for intensity changes.
Higher resolution means more accuracy.
Essentially, yes. And these models are constantly running, incorporating new data, learning, and improving.
And the data itself is better, too. Enhanced observations.
Crucially better. Those Hurricane Hunter planes flying into the storms, they deploy dropsondes, little sensor packs on parachutes, and use Doppler radar. That data can improve forecasts by up to 24%.
Brave work getting that data.
Incredible dedication. And then there's satellite technology. It's just revolutionized things.
Beyond just pictures of clouds.
Way beyond. Early 2000 satellites gave us cloud top views. Now, satellites like DOE-S 16 give stunningly clear images, sub-kilometer resolution.
Wow.
But the real game changer is microwave sensors, including on DOD satellites. They're like an MRI on the storm. They let scientists see through the clouds, assess the storm's internal structure, its potential for strengthening, how much rain it holds.
So you can see inside, not just the surface. That must help with predicting rapid intensification.
Exactly. It gives critical clues about whether a storm is about to explode in strength.
So better science, better tech, better forecasts. Is there a demonstrable economic value to this? Does it save money?
Immensely so. It's not just cool science. It's an incredible investment. HFP cost about $250 million over its first decade, 2009 to 2019.
Okay, seems like a lot, but...
But a 2024 economic analysis calculated the value of those improved forecasts at roughly $2 billion saved for every single major storm that makes landfall.
$2 billion per storm.
That's the estimate. The return on investment is staggering.
So spending on weather research isn't an expense. It's
like a 401k for national resilience, as one expert put it. It saves lives, protects property, and yields massive economic returns. It's a powerful argument against cutting science budgets.
A brilliant financial strategy, really.
When you look at it that way, yes.
But here's the harsh reality check. Even as our forecasts get better, the storms themselves seem to be getting worse. Climate change is amplifying the threat.
That's the unavoidable context now. Researchers are virtually certain climate change is making tropical cyclones more destructive. It adds a whole new layer of risk.
How exactly? What are the mechanisms?
Several key ways. First, hotter oceans. The Gulf of Mexico, for instance, is about 1 degree Celsius warmer than in the 1950s. That warmer water is pure fuel for hurricanes.
More energy, stronger storms.
And a higher likelihood of that dangerous rapid intensification. Less time to prepare for potentially stronger storms.
And the atmosphere itself.
Hotter atmosphere, more rain. A warmer atmosphere holds more moisture, about 7% more for every 1 degree Celsius rise.
Like a bigger sponge.
Exactly. So when a hurricane wrings that sponge out, you get more torrential rainfall. Climate change boosted Hurricane Harvey's rainfall by an estimated 15%. And remember, water surge and rain is often the biggest killer and causes the most damage.
Not just the wind.
Not just the wind. We're also seeing northward track shifts. Storms are tending to reach their peak intensity farther north.
Meaning places less prepared could get hit harder, like New York, maybe?
Potentially, yes. Cities that historically weren't in the primary impact zone might face greater threats. The risk map is changing.
And the possibility of multiple big storms at once, compounding disasters.
Climate change makes that more likely. We saw it in 2017 with Harvey, Irma, and Maria. That stretched even a better staffed FEMA thin. Imagine that scenario today with the backsliding concerns. It's worrying.
Especially since more people are living on the coasts. Increased coastal development.
That's another huge factor. Development in hurricane-prone areas has exploded. We're putting more people and more valuable property directly in the path of these stronger storms.
Building bigger targets.
Unfortunately, yes. And think about the aftermath. Vulnerability to heat.
Power outages after a storm in hotter conditions.
Exactly. Hotter baseline temperatures mean power outages are more dangerous. People left without AC for weeks face serious heat stress risks. We saw heat-related deaths after Katrina. That risk is amplified now.
And the ultimate cruel irony, the very forecast improvements we've made are now potentially at risk.
That's the fear. Cuts to the National Weather Service, the agency doing this vital work, could undermine our ability to forecast rapid intensification accurately just when climate change makes it more likely and more critical to predict. It's dangerously short-sighted.
So bringing this all together, the science is better, but the threat is growing, and our response systems might be weakening again. What does this mean for future resilience? What are the key takeaways for us?
Well, first, we have to continue the scientific push. No complacency. HFP is still setting goals, modeling storm cores 7 days out, better surge and rain forecasts. It's an ongoing race.
And importantly, integrating social science now. That seems new.
Hugely important. Recognizing that a perfect forecast is useless if people don't get it, understand it, or act on it.
So tailoring communication, understanding behavior.
Exactly. It's about making the science actionable for diverse communities, translating data into decisions.
But all this progress is threatened by the danger of disinvestment.
It really is. Experts warn cuts in chaos at agencies like NOAA could set us back years, losing the ground we've gained. It jeopardizes safety, it ignores the economic benefits of forecasting, it's gambling with lives and property.
Beyond the science, what about the human and systemic elements of preparedness? It's not just about levees, right?
Not at all. It's about social and economic planning, too. What happens to evacuees? Do host communities have resources? Katrina showed we need plans for the displaced, not just plans for the disaster zone.
Thinking about the whole picture.
The whole system. And community engagement is key. Bringing everyone in youth, marginalized groups makes planning stronger, builds resilience from the ground up. It can't be just top down.
And ultimately, Katrina hammered home the indispensable federal role.
Undeniably, no state can handle a catastrophe alone. The scale requires federal coordination, resources, expertise. Disengaging is not an option. Preparation, though costly, is always cheaper than recovery.
So the path forward seems clear, if challenging.
It requires sustained commitment. Strong federal support, coordination, investment and expertise, both scientific and logistical. We need to remember what worked after Katrina, the reforms, the investments, and make sure those aren't eroded. We have the roadmap. We just need the will to follow it.
So today on the Meteorology Matters podcast, we've really journeyed through Katrina's legacy, the incredible scientific leaps, but also these deeply concerning warnings about our current preparedness. The lessons are stark. We need a robust, coordinated, well-funded approach, especially as climate change loads the dice. We just can't afford amnesia.
Which really brings it back to you, our listener. What does being prepared truly mean now for you, your family, your community, the nation, with stronger storms and potentially weaker systems? How do we make sure the lessons of Katrina aren't just history, but are actually embedded in how we act so we don't repeat those systemic failures?
It's a vital question. Keep thinking about that balance of responsibility, local, state, federal, and what resilience looks like where you live. Your awareness matters. Thank you for joining us on this important edition of the Meteorology Matters podcast. We hope it gave you a deeper understanding and sparked some critical thinking.
Stay safe out there.
Before we go, don't forget to follow meteorologist Rob Jones on Instagram. He's at meteorologist. On TikTok, find him at TV Meteorologist. And over on YouTube, search for Rob Jones Hurricane. You can also find the Meteorology Matters podcast playlist there. Until next time, stay curious, stay informed, and stay safe.